Welcome to the Myeloma Team Podcast. I'm Kenny Capps. My podcast partner is Yolanda Brunson-Sarabo. Getting past the obstacles in life that throw at you often takes a team effort. When you or someone you care about is living with cancer, it takes a team. Now, as you already know, Yolanda and I share the same diagnosis, multiple myeloma, a blood cancer that creates cancerous plasma cells in the bone marrow that often affects bones and organs. And there are approximately 33,000 new cases of myeloma diagnosed every year in the United States. There currently is no cure, but every year there is more and more hope for living with this disease longer with a better quality of life. Now, we started this podcast to largely serve all who are affected by myeloma. But we recognize that there are so many similarities with others living with different cancers and chronic illnesses that we can't leave them out of the conversation. So today we're honored to talk with Adam Hayden, a writer, speaker, patient advocate for glioblastoma, the deadliest and most aggressive of brain cancers, which accounts for nearly 45% of all brain cancers. And this is a scary disease, and it's fatal for 95% of those who are diagnosed. Adam was diagnosed with brain cancer in 2016 while finishing up his master's in philosophy. He's taken his education and his experience, and he's put it to good use to write and speak about philosophy, illness, and healthcare from his unique perspective. He is a highly respected patient advocate in the brain tumor community, and he's a vocal supporter of palliative care. He is married to Whitney, and they have three boys, 9, 7, and 5. Is that right?
That's exactly right.
9, 7, and 5. Well, welcome.
Thank you. It's just terrific to be joining you. I'll have to say this. I love the podcast name, Myeloma Team. Right. And I was thinking about it. Myeloma ending in an A. Maybe you were the Myeloma A team.
Nice. So,
hey, I like that. You can take that one for free.
Yeah, thanks. All right. Gonna endorse that one. We'll give you credit for that one. Credit to Adam Hayden. Well, so since I seem to talk a lot, and I'll talk, and I spoke first, I'm going to ask the first question, and then I'm going to turn it over to Yolanda, because honestly, Yolanda is the reason why you're here, and she's the one who introduced you to us, and I'm really appreciative of that. But so I'm going to take the first question, actually, that Yolanda created for us. But then after that, Yolanda, let's go to town, and let's peg him with all sorts of questions. So tell us about glioblastoma, and how did you find out that you were diagnosed with glioblastoma?
Yeah, great. So glioblastoma, you know, it's one of these tough ones, right? It's a brain cancer. It's, you know, in the family of just brain tumors broadly. And though glioblastoma is perhaps the most aggressive, we like to say there's no such thing as a good brain tumor.
Right.
So there's a lot of affinities with all folks that are dealing with different brain tumors, regardless of they're benign or malignant. Glioblastoma itself is the fourth grade, the highest grade of brain malignancy that you can have. There are a couple of ways that, it is a primary brain tumor, meaning that it is not metastasized from another place in the body. And yet, for glioblastoma, some can be de novo. Some glioblastomas just appear as that bad thing itself. Other glioblastomas are called secondary glioblastomas, meaning that they transformed from a lower grade, even a non-malignant brain tumor. So in my case, it is one of those secondary types. So we didn't know it at the time, but for years, we don't know quite how long a brain tumor was growing itself inside my brain. At some point around 2015 or so, that's when my symptoms really started presenting with, a lot of intensity and difficulty in my life. That likely signaled this benign thing that we didn't know about probably underwent this malignant transformation then. Led to all these symptoms, finally got an MRI scan in 2016 after dealing with symptoms for over a year, in fact. And we said, oh gosh, this mean looking thing, in fact, is glioblastoma, the most aggressive type. I'm a young guy. You know, I mean, I was 34 when I was diagnosed. This is a disease that often impacts people that are in their mid-50s or older. It's a rare disease, and I'm sort of in a smaller subset of the population within that rare disease community.
So you were diagnosed when you were 34, is that what you said?
That's right. Yep.
Okay. And this was 2016. So you're 38 now. Is that right?
38 today.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent.
Oh, happy birthday.
But not, I know I said that in a way to make it sound like today. Okay. I just made when we're speaking God, today. No, I misphrased that, but
yeah. Yeah. Excellent. Okay. Yeah. So that is a scary disease. So what is the average age at diagnosis for this?
Yeah. So it's about 55 to 58, somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. So mid 50s.
Ahead of the curve.
Yeah. That's
always
right.
always trying to do stuff early, Adam. Let's just slow it down. Yeah. Well, Yolanda and I know about that. The disease we have, the average age is about 64, 65 years old. And both of us were much younger. In fact, I think Yolanda, you were still in your 30s, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was my early 40s. So, yep, it's a big difference.
Yeah. My grandfather, in fact, had multiple myeloma. I saw my mom kind of coordinate his care. Her mom had passed away a few years before. And then I sort of watched mom kind of coordinate the end of life care for my grandfather. He was 90 years old. So a good long life my grandfather lived. And in fact, when you live that long, my grandfather was retired just about the same amount of time that he worked. That's a good way to spend the last half of your life. But I've been especially interested in multiple myeloma just for those reasons that I had this kind of close personal family connection to it.
Sure. Right. Yeah. It's very interesting. So, Adam, how did you, I think for Kenny and I, we've spoken plenty of times, like, what was our reactions like when we were given those words? What was your reaction when you were diagnosed?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. It's a good question, right? And it's filled with so many different emotions, as likely you and folks you've talked to have felt as well. You know, it is scary, right? And something like glioblastoma, maybe there's a little bit more cultural awareness these days after Senator John McCain's diagnosis and death, for example, or former vice president, current Democratic candidate, Joe Biden's son, Beau Biden, sadly died from glioblastoma. So it may be in kind of the cultural conversation a little bit. But for us, back in 2016, my wife works in healthcare, so she was at least familiar with the term. I had never heard it before. So it was brand new information for us. I think the initial reaction, a couple of things stood out to us. One was when we heard the diagnosis, the nurse navigator who was in the room grabbed my hand and my wife's hand in each of her hands and just held our hands. And typically when somebody is holding your hand during an office visit, then you know it's serious. Exactly. So that was, even though I hadn't heard the word before, it was like, this is a big deal. But there's also part of getting the diagnosis that, and I've searched for these words, validating or affirming, almost relieving. So I was experiencing undiagnosed seizures, oftentimes brain tumors. We learn about them because a patient has a seizure and ends up in an emergency room. I was having these seizures for over a year, and I knew something was up. I was really healthy on paper, so the doctors didn't think brain tumor first. So I went to a lot of specialists and stuff, and though it was like, no, I know something is the matter here. So when we finally got the diagnosis, although terrifying and devastating because it's a life-limiting diagnosis, it's also a little bit like, I told you so. You know, there's a little bit of affirmation that comes along with it as well.
Wow.
Yeah. It's a complete side note. I was actually looking on your website, and there on your right forearm, it looks like there might be a tattoo of a glioblastoma. Is that right? What that is?
That's right. Yeah. It's a brain, and there's a scalpel kind of laid across the brain. And then, yes, there are these types of brain cells called astrocytes. Mm-hmm. There's a $4 word. When those astrocytes, when they mutate, that can lead to glioblastoma. It's actually a grade 4 astrocytoma is another clinical term for glioblastoma. So that's right. So that's the big forearm ode to this cancer.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's excellent. That's excellent. So So what was your immediate response, actually, once you were diagnosed? I know that I noticed that it pretty quickly after your diagnosis in 2016, you started writing. And so it seems to me that was one of your outlets. And again, how much longer did you have left in your master's program before you finished when you were diagnosed?
Yeah, so I was I was like right at the end. So I was doing a couple of independent studies with some professors that I had worked with through grad school. I had a couple of outstanding papers. My coursework was all wrapped up, and I was already sort of trying to get out on the job market. So I was, just at the very end, you know. So frustrating, but also meant that, you know, I could focus on getting those papers done. And it's interesting because, you know, you asked about kind of what was the immediate reaction. You're right that I turned to writing pretty quickly. Social media as well. I think people have applauded Whitney and I for being really public about our illness. And I think it's clearly a unique decision that every patient has to decide what's right for themselves. But for me, I was already Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, et cetera. So I just kept that up. You know, people say, wow, it was really brave of you to put that story online. I think, well, it would have been stranger if I had disappeared because I was, you know, a young guy already really active on social media. And also because I was in grad school, I was writing a lot. So it just changed the focus of my writing from kind of academic stuff into just lived experience and definitely was a therapeutic kind of outlet for me. Yeah.
Sure. So somewhat cathartic to actually be able to process your emotions and not even just so much publicly, I guess, but also just being able to get it out there and in almost a static way. It lives there for people to see for whenever they get around to seeing it, as opposed to having to have that conversation necessarily. But at least your emotions are out there when you have them. Right. That's what kind of what I can see. So what you said, social media, I know you're on Twitter. And of course you have your blog. What other social media platforms were you reaching out to?
Yeah. I think that I wish that I had stayed up with this stuff because I probably could put together some clever TikToks and stuff. I haven't done that.
Yeah. Now it's a way over my head. But yes, but I have two teenagers and a second grader. So who are all well-versed in TikToks and what they are and what they mean. They confuse the hell out of me. But yes, they are popular. The funny thing is that the people that are almost my age who have become addicted to them. And I don't know what that means, but yeah. But it obviously is an opportunity for people to have that conversation. And it's just in a different way, I guess. Although I don't know how you would do that as an advocate. Explain that to me. How would you do that as an advocate on a TikTok? What would you do? Because I'll mostly what I've seen are people, either mouthing words to songs or, you know, not even karaoke, lip syncing. And I've seen people lip sync speeches before, actually. So I guess you could be creative like that. How else would you do it?
Yeah. What would you do? I'm curious now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, are there certain, can you make like the idea of an infographic, but make it more interactive or something? So you're raising awareness about the community or something.
Okay. Right, because you can't create videos, I guess. And I guess just straight videos, there would be something. But again, they're more because they're shorter periods, right?
Right.
I don't know how long they are. Instagram's like 60 seconds or something like that, right? Video for videos, but I'm not sure about TikTok. I have no idea about TikTok. Because when I've seen them, they're being shown to me on somebody else's phone.
Sure, right.
All right. Well, just curious. That was a total side note. Anyways, so Yolanda.
Okay. So Adam, so why is it so important for you to be an advocate? You know, it's very well needed, especially in your area. But what gravitated, you know, why were you gravitated towards doing, being an advocate?
Yeah. I think a lot of different factors kind of came together. And what's funny is that I'm not sure, I didn't set out to sort of be this thing. I mean, I wasn't, because I had been pretty healthy most of my life. And, you know, I've had some experience. So my sister, for example, I've got a younger sister and younger brother. My sister's 4 years younger than I am. And sis has had both physical and developmental disabilities for her life. So I was aware of kind of just the disability community broadly, but it certainly not in a personal way any more than just loving my sister, you know, and seeing that impact on my family. So when I first started to get involved in patient advocacy, I probably didn't even know to call it that, you know. It was like, I got this thing, this disease. And it first came from this, they say, what, necessity is the mother of all invention or something. The first thing was, as a young guy with young kids, you know, with this really rare disease, and then not matching the typical patient profile, I think the first thing was like, there's not a lot of people that look like me that are doing this work, that are young and that are dealing with young kids and trying to figure out. I mean, our youngest was 8 months old when I was diagnosed. So it was like we were having questions about, you know, will he even remember his dad? I mean, the survival statistics are so grim. And thankfully, I've been able to perform against what the statistics would suggest. But, you know, I mean, he was 8 months old. He's five now, recently five. But we wonder, you know, what will he remember, Dad? And those conversations, I just didn't see them happening in the community because it's mostly folks that are later in life that are diagnosed with the disease. So I think the first advocacy steps for me, it was like, how do I reach out and find folks that are in similar circumstances that I am in? And then how can we work together to make sure that folks can find us, you know, when they're newly diagnosed? So that was probably the first way to get involved. And I'll share this story, too, if it's okay. Mm-hmm. I was after, so I had brain surgery to remove this big brain tumor, and it was a sizable thing. And because of we had to be aggressive with the surgery to get out as much tumor as possible. And of course, because it's in your brain, other parts of your body can be affected. So I was a wheelchair user after surgery because of the damage to my brain. And so I went to inpatient rehab right after discharge from the hospital. I, in fact, went to a neuro-specific rehabilitation hospital where I was on a locked brain trauma unit. Now, when I looked around at my peers on the brain trauma unit, I was in a wheelchair, was my reason for being there. But most of my sort of higher level executive function was still intact or is intact. And there were a lot of folks with brain injury who had pretty serious cognitive impairment. And as I looked around, it was like, who's speaking for these people? So that wasn't even about brain cancer, but just about sort of neurological injury. I saw that if these folks didn't have a voice of their own, I was worried who was speaking for them. Seeing that I had a voice, I think not because I thought I was anything special or not that I thought I should be a spokesperson, but just like I can articulate myself. I see that this is a really difficult environment in a locked brain trauma unit. Who's going to speak up for them? And so I felt this sort of pull to start just speaking openly about what was going on.
Wow. Now, okay, what is a locked?
What is this?
Yeah, like? What locked unit? What exactly is that?
Yeah, so it was in a rehab hospital, and I think you know when you're dealing with all sorts of brain trauma, whether that's a head injury, a sports injury, a car accident, a stroke, a hemorrhage in the brain, brain trauma and surgery, like me, because you get a lot of impacts to personality and to behavior, and that, you know, you all of a sudden you don't have your balance that you used to have. So typically, folks with brain trauma can make erratic decisions. I think, you know, through like the NFL, for example, I mean, sadly, we've seen that folks later in life, and even not later in life, but folks that have played professional football have then, you know, have had tremendous mental health and behavioral health issues. So similar to that. So folks in a brain trauma unit where they're receiving care to help recover lost function through physical therapy and occupational therapy or speech therapy, these folks also kind of have erratic behavior. So the floor that I was on was locked. We couldn't leave. The wheelchair that I was in had a wheelchair alarm. I couldn't get up. My bed had a bed alarm. So that's a lot of patient safety is driving those decisions. You don't want folks to fall out of bed and hurt themselves more than they already are there for care. You know, but also it's kind of a, you know, it can feel very isolating. And I don't want to pretend to understand the experience of being in prison, but you can feel a little bit like a prisoner because that, yeah. So the unit I was on, the floor I was on, it was locked. So you couldn't leave. You were there. Yeah.
That's so interesting.
That's intense.
How are you today? Like, what is your prognosis today?
Yeah. So I, I'm past the 4-year mark. So just to put that in kind of the big population statistics terms, a glioblastoma has, you know, about a 15 to 18 month median survival. So half the folks are gone before that time. Half the folks live longer than that. In that kind of survival curve, I'm certainly at the far end of it now at 4 years out. So sadly, many folks die in half the time. Or less that I've been living. So, you know, my prognosis, we're sort of on the other side of that half, that median survival. You know, there's a sense of like, okay, if you've been stable for this long, then, you know, we can feel a little bit more optimistic about the future. And yet, you know, there is nothing to cure this disease. It's not like we've got curative therapy that we can try and hope. We just don't have anything that even we would hope would cure the disease. So we know that glioblastoma, the nature of the disease itself, it is likely to recur. So many folks that you talk to that start to rack up years of survivorship have had 2 or 3 cancer recurrences, oftentimes multiple surgeries. Some folks I know have been through radiation therapy twice. So right now, my prognosis is I'm stable and I feel pretty strong day to day. That's not to say that my life isn't without plenty of symptoms. But I think compared to, you know, folks that have molecular profiles that are not as responsive to chemotherapy that mine have been, my prognosis is a little bit better, than those folks. I know that's kind of a vague answer.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
Not at all. Well, I mean, it's about as definite as most of us are used to, I think, anymore. So yeah, no, I get it. Are you on, maintenance therapy of some sort right now?
So I have concluded my maintenance chemotherapy. I'm not on any active treatment for the cancer today. I mean, I've got other like anti-epileptic meds to help control seizures and stuff, but no active chemo right now. We just know that this is sort of the lay of the land, is that chemo, because it's toxic and because it comes with risks, you know, there is a slim chance that if I were to continue the chemotherapy I was on, I could develop certain blood cancers, which of course you folks know about well. So there are mutations that can happen in bone marrow, for example, from continued exposure to this chemotherapy. There's also the risk that it sort of has kept the disease at bay for now. So it's like, we don't want too much of a good thing, and we want the option to use that therapy in the future if we need to again. So there's a sense of like, okay, right now we're just going to not have you on that. So I've been off active chemo for some time, which is a good thing, I think. Yeah.
Have you been able to do any sort of exercising, strength building, rehab, physical rehabilitation?
Yeah. So there was this long inpatient rehab stay. So I was in the hospital for about a month then. And that was a process to go from, you know, wheelchair to walker. And I left that hospital with a walker, but through outpatient therapy, sort of graduated to the use of a cane for getting around. I like to lift that up because I think that in the world, in American society or whatever, you know, we see folks walking with a cane and we think either, oh, they're old, or something really bad has happened to them. And I think for me, the cane represents an accomplishment, because that cane shows all the hard work I put in to get out of a wheelchair. So it's an interesting relationship. But yeah, you know, I mean, I do some stuff. I mean, I try to, you know, take walks around the block and stuff, you know, to stay at least a little bit active in these pandemic times. Yeah, but I mean, I've got so continued weakness on the left side of my body that will never go away, is just a side effect of surgery. And the
brain. Do you have any, so are you continuing to do either physical therapy or any sort of personal training or anything of that nature?
Yeah, I was, I was discharged from outpatient OT and PT with sort of, here's your at home regimen. And then it's kind of like, so what I've done is I've gone back for an evaluation about every 6 months or so, where we'll kind of do some strength tests and some evaluation tests and see if my, you know, if I've fallen off or if I've improved a little or lost a little. So the last time I went for one of those evaluations, I was just flat to where I had been the time before. So that was over about a 3-month period. I just kind of maintained the strength that I had through those at-home exercises. You know, so I just try to stay on top of those. And then through meeting with my oncologist, you know, part of that office visit, you know, he will measure reflexes and will look at my gait as, you know, as I ambulate around the office and stuff. Of course, that's different in virtual care settings now in COVID time. But that's kind of the ongoing monitoring that I'm involved in.
Okay. Yeah. Cause you know, Yolanda and I both are not only advocates for, well, for the disease that she and I share, but also for fitness through this. So being healthy and active through treatment and sort of preferably before treatment, before we get sick, but getting people to that place of balance. And so I think that that she and I would agree that it's so important to maintain sort of best quality of life. It would be to improve strength, balance, you know, range of motion. All of those things are invaluable into living a better quality of life. And very often they've shown that, you know, there have been many studies, of course, that have shown the value of responsiveness to treatment. I mean, based on that pain management, mental health, even so much of that is valuable. And so that I'm glad to hear that you're doing stuff yourself. I mean, although again, it's hard to do things in a clinical or gym setting these days, again, because of what we're all going through. And also now, do you have immune system compromised issues right now since you're not on chemotherapy?
Yeah. Well, so here's what's odd. And I think, and I don't, to whomever may listen to this, this is to share an experience, not to be critical, but I think to be observational about where we are right now. So when, you know, way back in kind of March, when we saw, I mean, I think February, right, there was grumblings about the pandemic and what's going to happen. And we knew that there were a couple of isolated cases, it seemed, and we were trying to figure out what's the right information federally. I'll step away. But, you know, so I reached out to my doctor.
And to clarify, I think you're in safe company here. So have at you. This is not G rated. So go to town.
Okay. I'm happy to have the permission to do that. Anyway, so, you know, and also Whitney, as I mentioned, so she's a healthcare worker. She's an occupational therapist. She works in a hospital. So, it, you know, when we learned of the pandemic spread, it was like, well, I've got brain cancer and she works in a hospital. So I think we felt like we got to take this really seriously. I emailed my doctor, of course, kind of right away, as soon as the news seemed like this was pretty serious. His response was that you are at a greater risk. And he said, in his words, you know, he said, I know you're not on active treatment today, but he said, you're still at risk. He said, and that risk is poorly understood. Now, I really trust my doctor. So that's not a knock that he said it's poorly understood as though he was missing information or something. I think the reality is it's a novel virus. So we just don't know how it's impacting the community. So he said to me, yes, you're at elevated risk. No, you're not on active treatment today. Please take every public health precaution to just take care of yourself. And so we've kind of been operating under that, you know, that's sort of the assumptions that we're going with. We're careful, I guess. Short story.
It's funny because I think this conversation was so well needed because there's so many similarities, right, Kenny? It's just like, absolutely. You know, brain cancer, blood cancer, whatever kind of cancer, we can all relate to some story, one or another. So it's funny because I'm in remission. So I just had tests done, like, what was it, a week ago, 2 weeks ago. So after our session, actually, I have a virtual with my doctor to kind of go over what it seems to be good news. However, just as you say, it's just, you just don't know. like you leave your house and now you have to just be careful that something doesn't activate what you have stable and inactive. So it's just this whole, you know, topsy-turvy thing, like, yay, but not really. Okay, you're still not, like, settled down, you know? So it's
what you just said about having those tests recently, you know, what was I think that really relates to our experience. So before, trying to think how that, like, to reverse engineer the timeline here, I had had a scan in February, an MRI. So that's the way that they, that my disease monitoring or surveillance, I go for MRI scans of my brain just about every 3 months. Sometimes a little more frequently if we see something weird. So we had noticed something weird during an MRI scan at the end of February, where my doctor said, you know, we want to keep our eyes on this. There wasn't quite, like all medical scans, you know, they're not like a perfect Polaroid picture, you know, that we're making some inferences based on what we're looking at or what we're seeing. And he said, you know, this is concerning. He said it could be an after effect from radiation. You know, I mean, I had a whole radiation protocol, and there's continued damage that can happen as a result of that. So he said we could just be seeing continued radiation damage, or it could be something else. So he said, you know, it'll be important that we stay really close to this. And then just a couple of weeks later, elective procedures were canceled. Our hospitals kind of shut down to visitors. I couldn't get in for the next follow-up scan. So, you know, that's how the COVID, that's how the pandemic can impact families of people living with cancer, right? Is that I needed a follow-up scan badly, and the hospital was really pushing back, trying not to schedule it. So it's like, man, what do you do? You know, in that case, that's tough.
Yeah. It's crazy because, you know, to kind of go off the rail a little bit, I know in terms of breast cancer, that's like a big thing now in terms of women getting mammograms. So they're like, the numbers are not looking good because usually every year, everyone, I guess, is doing what they're supposed to do, these women or men. And people are not doing that because first we're told, don't leave your house, okay? Or now you can leave your house. You know, it's just all of these mixed messages. And a lot of people are scared to get their yearly exams. It's just, I don't know what's going to happen, like, in another year. Like, you know, hopefully we don't see a lot of mortality. Well, we're already seeing that with the COVID, but that plus whatever else you had happened, you know. Yeah. It's crazy.
Yes. Those, and I think those excess deaths, you know, those measurements, yes. I've heard more about those recently. But yes, it is. I mean, we, of course, seeing the terrible COVID loss of life. Diabetes and heart attack. And I mean, these other, you know, that typically would be managed successfully or routinely in a hospital setting. If folks aren't going, you know, then that can have really catastrophic outcomes.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, how have you reevaluated, like, where you're at today? Like, you know, just as we're saying, you know, if you're in a safe zone now, just not to get too comfortable, but just how are you looking at your whole, you know, the perspective of today?
Yeah, thanks. Such a good and important question. So I think that there's, I really feel a sense of urgency. I mean, I think I realize that, you know, I feel pretty well day to day. So this is, I think, to the point, Kenny, that you were making too, just around maintaining fitness and activity levels and stuff. You know, I really try hard not to take that for granted. You know, I mean, I know that's a cliche thing to say, but I feel a sense of urgency that if I can get up and be active today, then I got to go for it. You know, I got to really make sure that I'm holding myself accountable to how I feel today, which also means if I'm having a rough day, it's okay to rest if I need it. But so long as I'm up and going, I keep myself busy. So I think that's been important to, you know, make sure that I don't go for too long without putting something on my schedule that asks me to push myself a little bit, you know, try not to be too complacent. You know, so if I've been invited to, like you say, you know, we met through that panel that I served on with AACR, you know, they invited me to do that. And, you know, that's an opportunity where it's like, yes, I'm going to commit to that. And, you know, that's going to give me something to look forward to benchmark, to make sure that I perform my best. And so I think just orienting my life around opportunities that force me to grow has been an important part of this time in my life.
Right.
Yeah, no, that's excellent. And that's really, I mean, I don't want to use the word brave, but or heroic, because it seems like the people throw that at advocates all the time. And sometimes that feels, as a patient advocate, sometimes disingenuous when you think, I'm just doing what I think I need to do in order to go forward. It's not even necessarily a right thing or a heroic thing. I don't remember anybody giving us options to do something else, right? But you do have to, I think sometimes it's strenuous mentally or psychologically strenuous to address things that are right in front of you. And so I think it's thank you for moving whatever that mountain is to look at it and look at it honestly. I don't know. I wonder if it's maybe your philosophy background that's sort of allowed you or encouraged you to explore that. But thank you for doing that. So Yolanda, do you have any other questions, last questions before we wrap things up?
One more to go. So, okay, can you give me in three words something encouraging for someone else going through this disease?
I've got those words.
Okay.
Can I contextualize them?
Sure.
I don't mean them to be flippant. Yep. Here's what I think. And this is not a plug for my blog, but I'm reminded that I wrote a post similar to this.
Plug away.
So I think those three words are you do you. And the reason I think those are the words is because I think too often we get swept up in what other people think we ought to be doing. You know, we get a diagnosis and all of a sudden people are like, oh, go on this diet or take this supplement or you got to see this person. Or you got to read this book. And I think what's been most helpful for me is like, what am I about as a person? And I'm about my family. I mean, cracking jokes and kind of having a dark sense of humor. I'm about reading and philosophy. So I think for me, it was like early on, I was like, I can't lose me in all of this stuff. And so when I start to feel anxious or stressed out or not sure what to do, I try to center myself and like, who is Adam? What am I about? And the stuff on my plate, is it consistent with sort of who I think I am? So yeah, so you do you, I think, is what I'm going with.
I love that.
Yeah, that's absolutely fantastic. Yep, absolutely. Dead perfect. And yep, probably clarification was helpful.
Yeah.
There. Yeah, that's right. Well, Adam, thank you so much for being a part of this necessary conversation. We really, really enjoyed the honesty and the revelations that you shared. Would you be willing to come back and talk with us again someday?
Anytime.
Good. Awesome. Because I think that would be, I think that's really important. Plus, we'd love to be able to keep up with you and what's going on with you and what new revelations you've come to. Because I'm sure that they're coming all the time. Aha moments seem to sneak up when dealing with something like this, I think. It seems to be important to me. So, well thanks for joining thanks for joining us again. I really, really do appreciate this.
Appreciate that, for sure.
Awesome. Yolanda, good luck at this virtual visit that you've got
coming up. Thank you so much. Thank you. I'll text you. No, I'll email you. Okay. I'll email you.
Well, thanks for joining the team today. If you want to follow Adam on Twitter, he's @ Adam Hayden. The last name is Hayden. His blog is glioblastology.com. If you have any other questions for me or for Yolanda, would like to have a conversation on a particular topic, or interested in sponsoring this podcast, please contact info@myelomateam.com. Our Patreon partner page is patreon.com/myelomateam. Your patronage will help us do more. We are on your team.